This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Hope you had a great July 4th holiday. Thanks to all the men and women and our service arms for what they do for us. And when we think about the greatness of this country, we think about you first. And so thank you. Hope everybody had a safe one, enjoyable one, and just excited to get back to talking football with you. As we, you know, I don't know if people know this, and I don't know if this is how you feel as fans, but when you get past July 4th, it's kind of the unofficial, it's not the beginning of the season, but it's the unofficial, hey, the season is right around the corner, let's heavily focus on it type season. College football conference media days begin in, I think, a couple of weeks. I'll be honest with you, I don't pay any attention to that, media press conferences, but fans do, you fans do, and it signals that college football is right around the corner. The NFL is just shortly a few weeks away from getting training camp. So once you hit the month and you get past July 4th, and you look, you got a couple of weeks, 2.5, 3 weeks, boom, you got NFL training camps getting started. You've got the start of fall practices in early August. So it's getting here, folks. I know the long wait has been tough for you, but we hope that this podcast like this can help you maybe delve into some aspects of football that you didn't have time to focus on. We have time to do it now. So we're going to really get into a number of things today. We've got a number of questions to answer. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the toughest schedules in college football, some programs that I think are going up and some are going down. Some of the top college coaching staffs in college football. We broke down the personnel position by position around college football. Hope you enjoyed that series. We're going to now get into the coaching staff. So we're going to do that. Look at some of the NFC coordinator changes in the NFL. Look at the Arizona Cardinals, and we're going to get into some information on, obviously, these suspensions that are taking place that you may have read about. Maybe you missed them due to the holiday. But we're going to talk a little bit about why they happen now and what does it really mean, and so on and so forth. All right, but I want to start, actually, with some of your questions today, and want to remind you of a couple of things. One, if you have a question that you want answered here, that's what we're here for. Send it to us. Contact Chris. I'll address it here. And don't be bashful. There's no such thing as a dumb question. We'll, you know, if you have a hard time trying to ask, you know, explaining what you want to ask, I'll try to be real broad and in depth to get your question answered. So don't be bashful. I won't mention your name if you don't want me to. You tell me whether you do want it or not. And we'll get it answered for you. So we love the interaction. We also love those of you that have joined our family at LandryFootball.com. And if you have not done so, we just think it's the best time, and it's running short. So take advantage of it now. We've got our summer savings special that is still around just for a tad longer. You get all the roster analysis, all the team previews. By the way, every major college football team preview has been up for over a week, 10 days now. We keep you up to date daily on what's going on around the college and NFL scene. So you can get 50% off any subscription package by using the coupon code SUMMER. Do it today. Become a member with us. Have the football season locked up. If you get the year membership now, you get it the football season for free. It's a great opportunity. Take advantage of it today. Wanted to address something that I guess was mentioned and was on, I guess, a local station or a national station. I'm not quite sure. Lincoln Riley made a comment about some things that is a lot of these comments taken out of hand. But I want to address something that has kind of been asked in form of a question. It's about Big 12 offenses and their defenses, how they respond to it, and kind of looking at SEC offenses in their defenses. And so we're going to get into kind of what he said. And what he said was that talking about Georgia's defense and how it wouldn't be as good, it wouldn't be ranked in the top five if they had to play Big 12 offenses every week. if you just take that snippet of a comment, it's true. If you had to play that style and you had to adjust your style to play in that conference, your defenses wouldn't be as good statistically. You'd give up a lot more points. You'd have to score a lot more points. But what that comment doesn't make and what Lincoln fails to mention is that if the focus is on how the defenses would respond to the Big 12 offenses, the bigger issue is what would the Big 12 defenses respond to a more power-laden offense? For example, and this is where I think people misunderstand football, don't understand the linkage between offense and defense and special team. They're one link that goes in a circle. You can't separate them because they all are affected by the other. If you had to defend power offenses, your offense, your explosive offense, wouldn't be on the field. You wouldn't get as many possessions. So you wouldn't score as many points. And if you want to look at it, and you know, if Lincoln wants to look at, for example, the semifinal game, the Rose Bowl game, you know, you hear about how Oklahoma dominated in the first half. They did. They had the game won. But what happened in the game? There was a second half, and Oklahoma's defense couldn't get off the field. They couldn't come up with one stop. And they also didn't have much success on offense against Georgia's defense in the second half. So it's not about what is better. It's different styles. Folks, you know, there's beauty in blondes, brunettes, redheads. There's nothing wrong. It's just styles. Styles make fights, but it makes teams. And you like what you like. I will say this, from years and years of coaching and scouting experience, the more explosive you are offensively, the more vulnerable you are to being upset by somebody that can do it just as well. Meaning, if you are a good power team, if you want to put one thing and sum up why Alabama's been the most consistently dominant program, it's because they minimize their ability to get beat by getting the best players and putting the opponent into submission consistently. They're just better. They're just physically more dominant, and they stay focused to dominate, and they're not going to allow a play here or a play there to cost them the game. These great spread offenses that have proliferated college football can be explosive. And when you watch highlights and you watch games and you catch them in a certain game, you think, oh, they can't be stopped, except when they have a off night a little bit or an off half, and then they're neutralized. Power teams are not neutralized. You're beaten if you're beaten by a more powerful team, but you don't have the common errors of a passing game where you drop a ball, a tip ball. If you're a power run team, yeah, you can fumble the football a bunch of times. Alabama did that against Ole Miss 2 years in a row, and it cost them. But it's less likely to happen, and it's rare for it to happen when you're dominant. So what I would say is if you watch that Georgia-Oklahoma game, clearly Georgia had a very bad game plan defensively going into it. They thought they could man up. They couldn't get pressure, and Oklahoma torched them. Georgia made great halftime adjustments. Give them credit for that. And they played a lot of two-deep shell and were physical with their receivers off the line of scrimmage, something they should have done the entire game. Oklahoma did not have their typical success on offense. They couldn't get the vertical seam route with the tight end. They couldn't do anything that they did in the first half with any sustainable success. And they couldn't get off the field defensively. Georgia dominated that game in the second half like Oklahoma dominated in the first half. But the point was, Oklahoma had the game in their hands, but they couldn't finish because a lot of it was their style. Now, it doesn't mean they can't win a national championship. But what I would say is that Oklahoma had to play in a conference like the SEC. They would have a harder time being successful on offense because teams in the SEC would run the football on their defense and limit their offensive possessions. Therefore, their offense at Oklahoma would still be good, but it wouldn't be as good statistically. And if you put Georgia in the Big 12, their defenses wouldn't be as good statistically, but their offenses would adjust and have to be a little different. And so I think that it's a little bit disingenuous and self-serving to say, you know, that somebody wouldn't be as good without also throwing yourself in the same boat And maybe as an offensive coach, Lincoln doesn't see that. But if he doesn't see it, he's wrong, because the reality is styles make fights. If you're in the Big 12, you better score a bunch of points. You better keep up. And good defenses are defined differently in that league. It is getting off the field occasionally, getting your offense an extra possession or two, and holding an opponent to 27 points while you score 30. You score 27 points in the SEC, you're going to win most games because it's a defense league. They've got better defensive personnel, and it's a little bit more old school, and people like what they like. People like certain styles, and that's it. But when you listen to Lincoln, you think they won the game instead of Georgia. Georgia won the game. They won the game because they dominated the second half. And I do believe had they strategically did a better job in the first half, they might have won that game going away. It does not mean that Oklahoma's style or program can't hang nationally. They can't. If you look at what Clemson has done, Clemson is more like Oklahoma offensively than the SEC schools. But Clemson's got some big war daddies on defense, and they can come in waves, and they can get the ball back and stifle an offense occasionally. Oklahoma's not able to do that yet. Now, Lincoln may get them there. In recruiting-wise, it looks like he's working towards that. So I think that Oklahoma looks more and more like a Clemson type of program than the SEC programs, which again, for an offensive coach, that's fine and it's great. It's exciting for fans. But just to clarify and to make sure that I think you get the whole story, again, people only tell you their half of the story to make themselves look good. And listen, if Georgia were to sit there, they'd tell you about what they could do and what Oklahoma couldn't do, and they'd brag about how they dominated in the second half and probably just blow off the first half. Well, you can't do that. You got to look at it in totality, study it, analyze it, and objectively. And I think that's the best way to describe it. If you put the other in the other league, it would be different. And their strength wouldn't be as strong. It wouldn't stand out as much. It would still be good, but you'd have to make some adjustments. All right, so let's continue with some questions about some other things, and then we'll get into some other things that I've got on the docket here. Matt asks, can you evaluate Pete Carroll as a head coach? Can you compare him to his peers in the college and pro game? In the pro game, I remember he didn't fare so well in New England or with the Jets, by the way, but he's obviously progressed since. Well, first of all, when he was with the Patriots and he was with the Jets, Pete did not have control over personnel. Now, in fairness, I don't think he was ready to have control over personnel, but there were some personnel decisions that were made above him that I think hampered his ability to be successful, and he wasn't as developed as a coach. Here's the thing. You know, people want to define somebody by how they were back at a certain point. You always develop and grow. You never stay the same as a player, as a coach, as a scout, as a salesman, as an architect, as an accountant, as a doctor, as a lawyer. You never stay the same. You either get better or you get worse. Pete has gotten better as a coach. When he went to USC, it's well known, he was like the seventh choice. They were turned down by everybody. Pete got the job. Pete was not just a really good recruiter, but he was a good evaluator of talent in finding guys that can fit and build the type of program that he wanted. And their defense was loaded. Their defense played his style of defense. A lot of that cover three, get after it with the front, and he recruited that. And at USC, listen, you have to, if you're recruiting in Southern California, you have to beat USC for every kid. They wake up wanting to go to USC. Pete made that work, and he evaluated well. And as he liked to say, he recruited 18 to 20 first-rounders every year. So he goes into college, and he really learned and developed as a coach, and he really did a good job in personnel. When he got the job in Seattle, he got control of personnel. And I don't know how many people are aware of this, but John Schneider, the GM, answers to Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll makes the final decisions on personnel. Now, Pete's very easygoing and really involves a lot of the personnel people in the decision-making process. But make no mistake that the blueprint of putting together that defense, that great-looking secondary for years, and the depth up front, and the linebackers that could run, that was Pete. It was all Pete. Now, they haven't been as successful in the draft as they were back then, but also they were having their run with a quarterback under a rookie contract at that time in Russell Wilson. Since they've had to pay Russell, they've had a hard time keeping some of this defense together. Some of the guys are stepping aside. They're getting old. In fact, Cam Chancellor, by the way, the enforcer, is retiring due to injuries. And so we'll see how well they can sustain it in Seattle, because can they draft as well as they did? They just went on a hot streak that hasn't been quite as hot in recent years. But that's the main reason. He's control of personnel. He has a good vision for what he wants, and he's really developed and grown as a coach. And again, he was very young and inexperienced when he got the job in New York with the Jets, and then, of course, with New England. Also asked about the assessment of the coaching staff at Notre Dame. Where do they rank against the top coaching staffs? The coaching staffs at Notre Dame are good. Look at Coach Elko was hired away, one of the best defense coordinators in the country. They identified him at Wake Forest, hired him, did a great job. They lost him to A&M. I think Brian Kelly's done a very good job. I think he's hired well. They pay well. They don't pay as well as some of the big-time programs. You ask, is the head coach is trying to win a championship, is there anything holding him back at Notre Dame besides academics? Besides academics, you can't say besides academics. That is it. Now, I think if you look at Notre Dame, they don't do anything like Alabama or A&M or, you know, Georgia or Clemson. They're not in the same ballgame. Academically, you're a freshman at Notre Dame, you got to take calculus. How many players does that rule take out? Notre Dame's motto, although they would never admit this, okay, but their motto should be what Stanford has become. Consistently good, well-coached, tough, physical. That's what they are. They made it to the championship game, as you know, a few years ago, and got dominated by Alabama. They didn't look anything like Alabama. Alabama was, it was men among boys. They can't recruit the same players. So when you say besides academics, that's enough. That'll determine everything. Notre Dame just recently got a new football facility. I say recent. Notre Dame, for years and years, were way behind major college programs for facilities. They still don't have a facility that would rival a Clemson or an Alabama or an A&M or an Oregon or places like that. No. They don't put that emphasis on it. They put the emphasis on academics, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But as a football fan, you need to understand that there is an emphasis on academics. There's a reason why Nick Saban was not interested in Notre Dame years ago. There's a reason why Urban Meyer, who grew up a Notre Dame fan, decided to go to Florida over Notre Dame, because he knew he could win more consistently at Florida. They do things over there differently that are more sustainable success-wise than Notre Dame. So, facility-wise, not as good, but getting better. I would say it's somewhat on the par now with some of the Big Ten schools, and it's facility-wise, it's pretty good. But academically, again, you're dealing with, you know, a Duke, Northwestern, Stanford-looking type academic situation. Yet people consider Notre Dame as should be a power. Everyone gives an attaboy to Stanford and Notre Dame and Duke for being good. Notre Dame gets criticized for doing the same thing. There is a difference. Notre Dame's more of a national brand. When you ask, can you explain how Notre Dame sustained their dominance for decades and they lost some of their competitiveness? Well, there's very simple. Notre Dame was the national college football program. College football was a regional sport, and still to some degree is a regional sport. Now it's just following every region. But college football for years, it was lined up this way. You won the Big Eight, you went to the Orange Bowl. You won the SEC, you went to the Sugar Bowl. You won the Big Ten and Pac-12, Big Ten, Pac-10 at the time, Pac-8 before that. You went to the Rose Bowl. Regional sports. Notre Dame was the only national one. College football had one game on TV on Saturday. Notre Dame was on there more often than not because they had a national brand. How did they become a national brand? Newt Rockne. Newt Rockne got his team on a train. They went out to California. It was a way to get their fan bases to go and travel and get out to the sunny California and they develop a fan base in California. Then they went to the East and, of course, played Army and Navy. They develop a fan base there. Later, in later years, they go down South and play, and they develop the national base. While everybody had their coaches show in their little markets, you know, in their little hometowns, Notre Dame had the only one-hour national coaches show hosted by the great Lindsey Nelson, and you could watch it in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Miami, Florida, New York City, Los Angeles, Houston, Texas, Chicago, everywhere. So Notre Dame was the national program. So they had that advantage. They could recruit that way. And the facilities weren't that big of a deal then. They were on TV more than anybody else. They went to different parts of the country to play more than anybody else. They were the national program. Today, everybody's a national program. Everybody's on TV, and you're going to be on TV more and more as you win, and your brand's going to grow. Clemson's no longer a little engine that could program. They're a national program. Alabama's the dominant program. You know, Texas has a lot of exposure. We're a dominant program at points in times. Not been as good. Why not? They're not winning. Make the case everybody's winning that is a national program because they're on TV a lot. So they lost their edge because Notre Dame has their NBC contract. Every game's on TV. So is every Alabama game. So is every Clemson game. I mean, maybe, you know, if you're the type that don't get all the college football packages, maybe you only see 10 games a weekend instead of, you know, 40 or 50 like I do, but everybody's on TV. So that edge has been lost. And you mentioned, like Nebraska, do you also believe it may be impossible for them to return to the standards of their glorious past? Well, it's nothing's impossible. Let me say this, that Notre Dame went through a spell after the late 70s success. They went into a spell in the early 80s where the program really went adrift. They went and hired Jerry Faust, a high school coach, success, not just a high school, a great, maybe one of the best high school coaches ever from Moeller High School in Cincinnati. And it just went in a tank. And they hired Lou Holtz. Notre Dame has done this in the past. There have been times where they have lacked their academic requirements to get the program, football program, back up. That most recent time was with Lou Holtz. Lou Holtz went out and recruited players. And I don't want to mention any names because I don't want it to be ugly, but I know from recruiting process and certainly from the draft process that Notre Dame run under Lou Holtz, they had a bunch of guys that couldn't tell you whether calculus starts with a C or a K, much less take it. They did that to get the program back up, the football, Notre Dame football brand back up, and they did. But that was also the reason why, in the good fathers at Notre Dame, and I say that as a raised Catholic, devout Catholic, the good fathers have a way of giving you something and then taking it away. When Notre Dame became, like, the football program became the it factor again, and it kind of overwhelmed and overtook the academic side, the good fathers took it back. And if you remember, if you're old enough to remember when Lou Holtz came up and said, you know, he was leaving Notre Dame, he wasn't finished coaching. He went on and coached at South Carolina, if you remember, obviously. Obviously, everyone remembers that. But if you remember, when he left, he said, it just felt like the right thing to do. Well, the right thing to do was, what they wouldn't tell you is that they said you were no longer going to take those guys academically. And Lou said, I'm not going to stay there. If Lou would have stayed there, he'd have struggled. Now, Bob Davey gets in and, you know, he struggles. And, you know, Bob Davey wasn't Lou Holtz, but he also didn't have the advantages. And so it went back to that. It is going to be very difficult for Notre Dame to compete at this level. In fact, it's again, like Stanford. Now, Stanford's good, but are they good enough to make the playoffs and beat an Alabama or a Georgia or somebody or a Clemson? They're not that good. They're close, but they're not that good. I think Notre Dame could be that. If they were to go back again and allow academically anybody to become, you know, go into the school like they did for a few years, sure they could get back. I don't think they want to do that. It's a little different. Notre Dame's brand, as good as Nebraska's brand is, it's not Notre Dame. Notre Dame still has a national brand, and it still is a polarizing school. They are an independent because they can be. They can get a contract by NBC because they're Notre Dame, and NBC still loves it because they still put a ton of eyeballs to watch Notre Dame, even when they're a 3 or 4 win team. When they're good, Notre Dame's success is through the roof, or, you know, popularity is through the roof. And the hype machine, positively and negatively, of Notre Dame is always going to be erratic. You don't have many people that are objective on Notre Dame. They either love them or hate them. So, no, I think that's what their ceiling is now, which means, you know, can they get to the national playoffs? Absolutely they can. Can they win consistently nationally? No, not unless they make some adjustments to their academic side of it. Greg asks, do you think Dan Mullen can bring Florida to a national championship? Explain. Then how well will Mississippi State do this year? Well, let's take the Mississippi State one. I think they're going to do well. I think Joel Moorhead's a good fit. This is a really good Mississippi State team. If I'm looking at the defensive lines in the SEC that jump out at me, Alabama's made a lot of changes, but they're loaded with talent. Auburn's very good. Mississippi State's not to their depth, but are really good. This is a good team that Joe Moorhead has. How good can they be long-term? We'll determine about his ability to accurately evaluate players in recruiting and build them through the system like Dan did. Dan did that exceedingly well, and that will be determined over time. But this year, you're going to like what Joe Moorhead's going to do with this team, I do believe. In fact, if they don't, you know, win a lot, then I think it'll be a huge disappointment because I think the potential is there. Do you think Dan Mullen can bring Florida to a national championship? I do. But let me tell you what needs to happen. One, the guy's one hell of a coach in terms of developing players. I think he's always done a good job of evaluating and putting a staff together. He certainly can at least fix that offense and get a lot out of that team. But remember, he's not at Mississippi State anymore. Pulling an upset a year, winning 8-9 games and going to bowl games is not going to be enough at Florida long-term. Maybe short-term this year, but long-term, no, it's not. You want to see national championships. That's why you asked the question. So what is the variable? Is it coaching? I think Dan's a really good coach. Can he develop players? Yeah. Can he hire a good staff? But can he get the right guys? Time will tell. I think so. Here's the thing that he's going to have to do that he's not had to do before as a head coach since his days as an assistant coach at Florida. And he's going to have to recruit at the highest level. In essence, what's the program that is right now, at least in the short term, the standard barrier in the SEC East? It's Georgia. Georgia's recruiting like Alabama. They're recruiting at an elite level. Florida's got to do that. If Florida doesn't recruit to Georgia's level, I think they might win. They'll win one, maybe. Maybe, if they're lucky, two out of every five games they play. Georgia's going to win. Florida has to recruit like that. Now, it takes a little time to get footing. So we're going to see this next class, 2019, what it can be at Florida. That's the key. If they can do that, then Florida, Georgia is going to be on again. That's the two programs that has the resources and the recruiting base to be the programs in the East of the SEC. So that's the key. And can he do it? Yes. Will he do it? Don't know. And here's the thing. You've got guys that do really good jobs that don't get credit for doing a good job because somebody that's in their own division or in their own conference that's just doing it better. Les Miles did a pretty good job at LSU. He got fired. Been some coaches that have done a pretty good job at Auburn. They got fired because they are a not even close to what Alabama is. For Dan to win championships, he's going to have to sustain the things that he's good at, and he's going to have to recruit to the same level that Georgia is. They can? Sure, they can be in that mix. If they don't, they'll fall short. Speaking of SEC, I'm asked about the opinion of Phil Fulmer as a head coach and his place among head coaching peers. Phillip was a great recruiter. Phillip took over for Johnny Majors and was a great recruiter. That was his strength. He had some pretty good coaches. Then he held on to some coaches that weren't as good. Once the recruiting slipped a little bit, and it slipped after they won the national championship, ironically, Phillip was not good at adjusting. Phillip Fulmer was in his time what Les Miles was. Phillip Fulmer and Les Miles were as close of a head coaches that you can imagine in terms of their personality. Now, Les was a little quirkier. You know, Phillip was folksier from Maryville, and Les was a quirky Bo Schembechler disciple, so they weren't alike in that regard. But both played offensive line in college. Both became head coaches. Both good recruiters. Both were not the great X's and O guys, and both were stubborn. Phillip had a system that worked, and he would say, we won an awful lot of games over here doing it like that. He couldn't, you know, there were times where he didn't have the edge against Florida. He had the personnel, but he didn't have the edge on the sidelines, or they could have beaten Florida maybe more than they did. They didn't because Spurrier outcoached him. Spurrier had great talent, but so did Tennessee. But Spurrier outcoached him more often than not. But Phillip had a lot of success. But when some coaching hires didn't work out, recruiting slipped a little bit here or there, it exposed him, and the program gradually declined. He was a good coach, good program builder. People around the university liked him. Could have been there, still be coaching there, if he had won more on a national level. But he wasn't a great guy at making adjustments to the modern game. And what does that sound like? That sounds like Les Miles. He's not someone I would consider hiring as he's tried to get head coaching jobs. He's not someone that I think would be a good fit in today's game. Tennessee fans are overjoyed as having Phil as the AD because they can knows how to provide the Tennessee head coach with the tools that he needs. Well, yes and no. First of all, the reason why the folks at Tennessee are, it's very provincial in the South. You have to go back to Tennessee. They loved it when Lane Kiffin was there until Lane, you know, left, and then they hated him. Then they had an athletic director that was somebody that did things differently, and he alienated people. And Phillip was kind of one of those guys that had a lot of contacts and a lot of friends, and he was always on the outside chirping in. And, of course, there were athletic directors after Doug Dickey left that really botched the program. They lost Lane Kiffin to USC. It was a bad timing, and they really didn't do a good job with the hire, and they got Derek Dooley, and that set the program back. And then, you know, you go on and on, and Butch Jones was not the answer, and the athletic director wasn't the answer. And it's been administrative screw-up after screw-up. Phillip walks in with the white hat because he's the good old boy from Maryville. He's their guy. Phillip has no real acumen to be an athletic director. What Phillip has is the ability to bring a community together, and that's what he's there for. And I think he's going to do a good job with that. You know, Jeremy Pruitt, his success at Tennessee, he's in a different situation than Kirby Smart is at Georgia. There's greater fertile resources at Georgia than there is at Tennessee recruiting-wise. Jeremy is going to know how the Tennessee program should look. What Jeremy brings to the table is an Alabama way and a style. And if Tennessee's willing to make the support staff the way it's supposed to be, like Alabama, make the facility upgrades, then he has a much better chance of being successful. That's not coming from Phillip. That's coming from the new head coach who has been at the premier program, and he is basically said, this is what we need to do to be successful. See, that's what Kirby Smart did when he went to Georgia. We need to have A, B, C, X, Y, Z, because that's the way Alabama does it, and that's the way it needs to be if we're going to compete against them. And he's got them to buy in at Georgia, and he's certainly got them to buy in with his success on the field in his second year. Jeremy's going to have to get the powers that be at Tennessee, including Phillip Fulmer, to buy into that we got to do that. They have to be willing to spend the money like Alabama does. If you don't do what they do, you're going to fall short. Doesn't mean you can't upset them and beat them, but you're just not going to do it on a regular basis. And if you just want to be good and wait till Nick Saban retires and then Alabama falls back to the pack, well, then everybody's in it then. But right now, if the standard bearer is Alabama, Tennessee needs to do and take the model of what Georgia did. Now, by hiring Jeremy Pruitt, they took that model. Now, is Jeremy as experienced and as polished as Kirby? Not quite, but he does sound, walk, and talk like one of their own at Tennessee. He's got the Alabama draw, but that's close enough. And he's got the Alabama pedigree, which is the blueprint. So, you know, can Philip provide the tools? He can, but Jeremy's going to tell him what's needed, and Philip's going to need to be able to provide that. I don't think it's as much about Philip as much it's about Jeremy getting Philip to buy in, and then Philip can be the guy that can be the one that can sell it to the booster. So maybe that's what you're asking. I don't know. Does Philip know how to build it? Well, to a degree he does, but he also let it slip as well. Jeremy's going to be the one to say, here's what I want. Here's the blueprint. You go sell it to the boosters and to the upper administration to get this for me. I think Philip can do that, whereas maybe some athletic directors could not, because Philip is one of their own. All right, and also get asked about my evaluation of Tony Mandarich coming out. Many consider it the classic high draft pick bust. Talks about his comeback and his starting career with the coach. Is it fair to label him as a bust? He wasn't a complete bust. You're right. He did play well for the coach. Let me explain something that happened during that time. Tony Mandarich was on steroids. People didn't understand what steroids did to you at this point. If you watch this guy to this point in my years of following or scouting or coaching, I've not seen an offensive lineman dominate like this guy. Now, if you watch his tape in college at Michigan State, it's the perfect example of roid rage on a football field. This guy dominated like no other. Now, again, what people didn't understand was, you know, the effects of why it was doing it. In fact, one of the reasons why we have guys at the combine take their shirt off, it was because you learned soon from doctors that if you could see back acne, you could determine that was usually an indication of steroid use. Again, not much was understood about it. He was a bust relative to what he could have been or what he thought he was going to be. But when you consider that you could have had like an Aikman or a Barry Sanders, it's tough to take for certainly the Packers. But he was a bust for the Packers, but he did have success. So some really fair points. Going to get to a couple of things. Gosh, I'm running a little long again. Tend to do that. I apologize. We're going to keep some of this stuff. We're going to look at the whole the NFL stuff for next week. Going to finish up with top coaching staffs in college football. And what we'll do next week, I promise we'll get to it. Some of the toughest schedules in college football, some programs going up and down, and get into some NFL stuff. But want to finish up kind of our evaluation of units and the coaching units. And I think when you look at coaching staffs, you got to look at it, and you got to have a real understanding of coaching and who does a good job and maybe who has a good reputation. But I think you got to look at the head coach. You got to look at the coordinators and key assistants, recruiters, developers. If you want to know the most important position coaches, once you behind the coordinators, head coach, the coordinators, the real key positions are the strength coach and the offensive line coach and the secondary coach. Those are really key. The best program by far is got the best coaching staff by far, and that's Alabama. Nick Saban's the best that's ever been in college football. His ability to hire people that are really good. You know, you put a Mike Locksley and a Josh Gattis to replace Brian Daboll. Pete Golding and Tosh Lupoi will handle the defense. Dan Enos comes in. Craig Kulikowski, best pass rushing coach in college football, coach the defensive line. It's the deepest and best staff. They pay a lot of money, but he's also good at identifying the right guys. You can pay a lot of money to the wrong guys, folks. He doesn't. He gets it done. Right under them is Ohio State's Urban Meyer and his staff. Unbelievable. I mean, he did the same thing, bringing Kevin Wilson and Greg Schiano in. Ryan, he does the Saban thing too. He learned it from watching Saban. He'll get the co-coordinator thing going, and he'll get the coordinator in waiting going. You get Alex Grinch being brought in as a co-rising young defensive coordinator to work with Greg Schiano. So when Greg gets a job, Alex can jump in. Larry Johnson is one of the best assistants in terms of teachers and particularly recruiters. Great staff. Dabo Swinney's done a great job with his staff at Clemson. Dabo himself is not a great X's and O guy, but he's a great salesman. He's a great leader, and he's a recruiter. I mean, he's a recruiter of coaches and of players. He's had Brent Venables for a long time. He's not had to replace him. Offensively, he's been able to put good pieces together. Chad Morris leaves. He puts Tony Elliott and Jeff Scott in position. Same model. Kind of learned it from Saban. Have two good guys. One leaves. You got the other. Bring in somebody in. It's like you have a coordinator in waiting. That's what Saban has done. And he learned that. When he went to the Dolphins, Saban and I talked a little bit about, he had Wayne Huizenga, who, by the way, recently passed. And he gave him a really large budget for his coaching staff. And one of the things Nick did, and we talked about how he should put it together, yeah, he's got coordinators. And he's got like an assistant coordinator. And then he had a defensive line coach, an assistant defensive line coach, a linebacker coach, and a second linebacker coach. And it was because as he lose guys, he wanted to have somebody already groomed in the system. So, and he's taken that whole process to Alabama where they've got the resources to be able to do that. Not many colleges can do that, believe it or not. So it's the foresight, it's the vision, and it's the money all together that makes him a power. Washington and Chris Peterson does a really good job. First of all, he's a great coach himself, but he got a lot of his guys from Boise to him. But, Jimmy Lake and Pete Kwiatkowski, but you know, you get Bush Hamden comes over from the Falcons and from the Seahawks, and you know, he's just done a really good job with his coaching staff. Really good. Georgia's coaching staff, Kirby's done a good job. Auburn staff is pretty good. Michigan State is a great coaching staff. Utah gets a lot out of his staff, very good staff, as does Wisconsin. Texas A&M and Jimbo Fisher's put together a good staff. I think Michigan's defensive staff is really good, and maybe his offensive staff will get a little bit better, and if he can, that's when Michigan can start to take a step up. All right, look, folks, we're going to get into some of the toughest schedules, programs going up and down, a lot more NFL stuff for you on Tuesday when we reconvene on the Landry Football Podcast. Want to remind you again, summer savings special is up. Become a member today. Get 50% off of any membership package by using the coupon code SUMMER. Join it today. And folks, if you want us to promote your business, contact us at chris@landryfootball.com or hit the contact us button. We'll help you grow your brand right here at landryfootball.com. We appreciate you joining us. We'll talk to you again Tuesday in another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on landryfootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to landryfootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at Landry Football. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Now, I attribute that spike in crime to what I've said in Baltimore, Ferguson, and all these other places where we've seen these so-called protests and all of this stuff about police misuse of force and police just doing certain things to certain demographics. I attribute that to police don't want to be labeled as a racist. They don't want to be on the 6 o'clock news. They definitely don't want to be on CNN. They don't want to be on all these mainstream medias. They don't want to be on World Star. They don't want to be on Twitter. They don't want to be on Facebook Live. So you have officers that aren't wanting to do their job simply because they know if they do their job, and even when they're doing it by the book, someone's going to label them as being the bad guy. And that's exactly what many of these officers in Indianapolis have said, including the FOP president, Rick Snyder.
Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.